Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, the weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
And I'm Chris Murphy. We're here to discuss the fifth episode of the HBO series The White Lotus, That's Amore. Although pretty much nothing in this episode resembles actual love, but there are a lot of beautiful things
the episode. Yeah. Speaking of beautiful things, later in the episode I'll be talking to Adam DeMarco, who plays Albie. I have questions for him about, you know, what's going on with him and whether this fantasy with Lucia is actually good or real.
Good or real. Yeah. There is also the ongoing and all-important question of who winds up dead at the end of the show, which definitely got a lot more interesting this episode, I would say. Each week at the end of the episode, Richard and I are going to debate who we think is dead.
We'll also fold in your theories about who winds up floating in the Mediterranean. But Chris and I really have to keep each other, you know, in check and sort of responsible for our wild predictions.
Yeah.
And so whoever's rightest by the end gets an Aperol Spritz bought by the other one.
Yes. Oh, okay. We just raised the stakes even
money
more.
Involved, buddy. Yeah.
Now there's
yeah.
money on the line. Yeah. Wow. My theories are going to get so much more specific and better now.
So, Chris, I think we should start with the ending.
And right. What a finale it was. What a finish.
Last week, we were sort of cautiously optimistic for Tanya and Quentin and her new cadre of gay friends. But we were also like, probably something is off. And I think something is decidedly off.
Yeah,
now.
Something is not the way that it was presented to us initially.
Yeah. Maybe Jack is his nephew and they just have a peculiar relationship. Or maybe there's something else going on.
Yeah, I mean, the moment when Tanya, sort of in a daze in the middle of the night, stumbles upon Jack just absolutely going to town on yeah. Quentin, I was like, yeah, something's not right here. That's yeah. what the first thing that I said. but I feel like, and now I feel silly, that I just took at face value that Jack and Quentin were nephew and uncle.
Right.
It seems like it might be a rent boy situation.
Yeah, yeah, or a co-conspirator kind of thing. I think that, like, I mean, there were times in the old days, I'm told, when closeted gay men, I mean, everyone was pretty much closeted in the old days, would kind of take younger men as their wards or would adopt them even to, or like maybe it was a nephew or whatever. Like, that was kind of a practice. So maybe it's a throwback to, you know, when the original people lived in this palazzo. You know, I don't know what's going on.
I'm laughing because while that could be true, I feel like now Occam's razor, like, they're lying to Portia and Tanya. Yeah. They're in cahoots. They're going to take our money.
And I think there are other parts of this episode that point towards something sinister. I mean, we have Jack and Portia on this, like, Palermo evening out, and then he, like, has them dine and dash, which is, like, maybe it was just for the sort of illicit thrill of it, but maybe he, like, literally didn't have money.
Yeah, but it was unnecessary either way because Portia says, I could have paid for that.
Right, right.
So clearly he, you know, maybe he wanted to just have fun and, you know,
sure.
have an adventure, and she's getting her adventure, but that doesn't really add up or seem necessary considering that they're staying in a huge-ass mansion
right.
in Palermo. How does he not have money for Arancini?
I mean, it's certainly a way to quickly bond with her.
Yeah.
Right. We're like now we're co-conspirators. We're sort of like Bonnie and Clyde running
and
from the
get her under his yep. spell mm-hmm. even further, especially if his ultimate plan is to take advantage of her right. and Tanya.
Right.
Didn't consider that.
It is funny though that like immediately after this date, Jack is like, I have to go help my uncle with something, which is like, I have to go fuck.
You know, I have to go like, fuck my uncle in right. the ass.
Like very soon after our date has concluded. Yeah. I think the other moment of. Well, maybe there too, but like between Quentin and Tanya is there, I mean, Tanya is really lucid this episode in a kind of interesting way. I liked it on the yacht. She was like, you were having sex in the boat. I think that's what you're doing. She's kind of like being fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then later, I think it's after the opera, she and Quentin are talking and he seems kind of weary and he talks about his like the one love of his life, who is a cowboy in Wyoming. And I'm like,
me.
Is this guy just talking about Brokeback Mountain?
I was
like,
about
is
to
this
say...
a fake story?
Brokeback yeah. Mountain without any of the sex in a tent.
Right. I wonder how real that story is. And also, they're talking about beauty. And he's like, that's my vice. My vice is not love. I don't suffer for this. It's beauty is what obsesses me.
No, no. Other than the cowboy, love's never been my Achilles heel. It was always beauty.
I live for beauty.
I know you do.
Yeah.
I'd also die for beauty, wouldn't you? A world without beauty. It's not a world I want to live in.
Is he kind of almost telling her that, like, I might have to kill you to keep this palazzo going.
Wow.
You know, like, or something. I don't know. I feel like there was something where it turned, like, he was almost sort of telling her something true about himself,
yes.
about what was actually going on.
Oh, that's so interesting, because I didn't think of it as, like, a direct threat mm-hmm. to Tanya. But I thought of it more as the dichotomy or sort of the separation, the difference between love and beauty and sort of what's on the outside and what might be deeper and more on the inside. And I tracked that conversation about beauty to the sort of distortion that that palazzo looks so gorgeous when you're entering it, and those scenes and all the art, it's so pretty at first. And then right when Tanya wakes up in the middle of the night, that beauty becomes sort of grotesque and
yeah.
disgusting, and the way that it's shot, it becomes ugly in a way. And then she stumbles upon this beautiful man, Jack, doing something. And not that I think gay sex is ugly, that's
right.
not what I'm saying, but doing something that is carnal and
yeah.
and not what you'd expect.
Not
I guess,
poetic.
Not poetic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Something, a beautiful person may be doing something sinister and
right.
and nefarious.
I think that like the aesthetically, the way that Mike White shoots this and how he uses the score is so effectively, exactly what you just said about the house turning all of a sudden into a house of horrors.
Yeah.
And I was thinking that earlier, there's a shot that's kind of it's, you know, kind of pushing in on the entrance with those big fire pits that are lit, you know?
Uh-huh.
And from one angle, you're like, oh, what beautiful grandeur, you know? But then when Mike White puts in the right score, you're like, oh, this is like an entrance to hell.
Yeah.
Like it's amazing how much it can shift just because the music is a little different or whatever.
The gates of hell.
Yeah.
Wow. I did not even consider that. This rich gay man, Quentin, couldn't afford to keep his house anymore.
Yeah.
Although it does go back to what he said at the very beginning, where he could have taken subsidies from Italy, from the
yeah.
government, if he agreed to let the public in.
Right.
But of course, he wants to hoard it and keep it to himself. And they have that whole sort of funny but very sort of dark exchange where it's like, I'd rather keep this to myself and not take any money
mm-hmm.
than let commoners, let other people.
Yeah, and Tanya says, oh,
house.
No, the public can't be in here.
The public can't come here.
So he has alluded to money problems
yeah.
or you know, at least past money problems. And again, you know, I brought this up like last week, I think, that line of Cameron in episode 2 where he says these people, these rich, these Europeans with these big estates who have no money. So like, I think that Mike White was leaving us some breadcrumbs. I mean, that's my best guess anyway.
Mm.
And like, you know, Quentin taking Tanya to see, what was it, Madame Butterfly?
Madame Butterfly. Ugh.
At the Opera House, and where Tanya met the Queen of Sicily,
yeah,
which is exciting for her.
So happy for her. And that was like, oh, Quentin, you're being gay mean, but I was laughing.
Yeah, it was gay mean. It was also like, I mean, you know, I'm sort of only half joking about, like, is Quentin just pulling this story from Brokeback Mountain? But, like, is he pulling this whole evening from Pretty Woman? Does he know that that's something that, like, Tanya will be like, oh, you know, we've already seen Tanya earlier in the season be like, I want to be like Monica Vitti. I want to be like, you know, those old movies. Like, maybe Pretty Woman.
It could be Moonlight. Moonstruck.
Yeah.
Sorry, Barry Jenkins. It could be Moonstruck.
It's more Moonlight toward the end. But
there are all these sort of narratives he's pulling. He might realize that Tanya is kind of, I don't want to not give her enough credit, but a simpler woman in some respects, and really can fall for glitz and glamour and storytelling, and wants to, you know, live an extraordinary and beautiful and cinematic life.
Right.
And hasn't had that opportunity. And so by pulling these yarns from Pretty Woman, from Moonstruck, from Brokeback Mountain, if you will, he might be absolutely ensnaring her into his web of lies.
Yeah.
They all might be lies.
Yeah. And in a way, like him saying the thing about would you die for beauty might have been a way to test her, which is like, how simple is your conception of this experience? And it proves to be she's not thinking in any sort of deeper level. She's just like, to her, beauty means like literally like nice clothes or a nice house or whatever. But he's talking about
Sicily.
Something much more like, I want to live a beautiful life and I need money to do that.
Well,
you know?
Now it's actually so crazy. And I love the cliffhanger, because now Tanya actually has all the power. She has all the cards.
Right.
Because he, at least from the angle that we saw, Quentin didn't seem to be noticing that Tanya was in the room and that she now knows that Jack and Quentin have this illicit relationship.
Yeah. Of some kind of nature. We're not entirely sure. But like, I'm very curious to see what she does with that.
Well, I think this is going to show how much she cares about Portia, right? Because she knows that Jack and Portia have been having sex on the boat, that Portia really likes him. And so for her to see Jack fucking Quentin, I think it's really going to come down to how does Tanya really feel about Portia and how much does she want to protect Portia?
Yeah, that's a really good point. I hadn't thought about that, but that's true. Like, and I guess it goes back to that scene on the boat where, like, there's a warmth between them, you know, in a way that, like, we haven't always seen between Tanya and Portia. Tanya has treated her terribly often, but, like, here and there, increasingly, we are seeing moments of like it's almost a little like big sistery, or there's a certain familial energy there.
Well, it's interesting. I interviewed Haley Lou Richardson for episode 4 of the pod, and I had never thought of this, but Haley said quite astutely that she feels that Portia is in danger of becoming Tanya.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, and like, so in that light, it's these familiar, these like more like affectionate moments are kind of bad for Portia.
Yeah.
It's like, oh no, you don't want to get too close to this because you might be in danger.
But it also might be good for Tanya, because Tanya is really only capable of caring about herself. So if she sees herself in Portia, she might be more willing and able to help her.
So we should talk about the other sort of sinisterly sexual aspect that entered this episode, which is kind of between Cameron and Harper.
Oh, yeah. A leg touch of the century.
So the big kind of opening scene with this quartet story in this episode is that, of course, Ethan finds the condom wrapper that Harper very purposely left on the bathroom
counter.
Condom
wrapper.
Mm-hmm. And you said something last week where you were like, no, the lawyer in her is giving him time to either further implicate himself or to explain himself. And she says exactly that. She's like, I gave you all of yesterday to come clean and you didn't say anything. Mm-hmm. You just lied to me. Yeah.
You met two hookers at the bar and brought them back to our room and Cameron had sex with them on the couch?
I can't remember because, like, I was wasted, but...
What were you doing? Were you just watching?
I was just sitting there. I was going to bed. They came in and then, I mean, I don't know. I can't remember. I was really out of it.
And you didn't do anything with these hookers?
No, I didn't do any of the sex stuff. I mean, one of them, like at one point, one of them tried to kiss me, but I freaked out, so nothing happened. I promise. Okay, look, we took Molly. I mean, I know that sounds bad, but...
Yeah, it sounds really fucking bad. I was gone for one fucking night, and you did Molly with hookers?
Yeah.
And I come back and find a condom wrapper on the couch?
Yeah,
what the
but
fuck?
Look, I swear to you, I didn't do anything, okay? I'm not lying.
You already have lied to me.
No, I have not. When have I lied to you? I haven't
yes,
lied
you
to you.
Yes, you have.
When?
I gave you every chance yesterday to tell me what happened, and you fucking bullshitted me.
Well, I didn't tell you everything, yeah.
To say the least.
It's so funny because that argument, which was so fantastic and well acted on both Ethan's part and Harper's part, I did find myself, and this is going to maybe show my deep flawedness. I did find myself sort of siding with Ethan in that, like, it could have been so much worse. He could have engaged. He didn't engage. While he lied to her repeatedly, 100%, she caught him red-handed. I could understand Ethan's frustration being like, you know how much self-restraint it would take in that situation, potentially, if you're, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. want to go off and party with the boys and or attracted to me and Lucia to say no to that. And he, as far as we can tell, he actually did.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I thought that argument, honestly, not to be a both sides there, but I understood. I could see both sides of that.
Yes, I can certainly see Harper saying, like, you had hookers in here and you were on Mol or ecstasy. Or
I leave
like,
for one night.
Like,
and
literally, I was gone for 24 hours and this is what happens. But I also think that, like, the opportunity that Ethan potentially missed out on, and I think it's that's part of the character, is that he isn't, he's a sort of guileless person. He's honest to a fault, maybe, mm-hmm. or, I mean, he wasn't being honest here, but he's sort of, like, he doesn't think strategically.
No.
And the best strategy with Harper would have been, oh my God, you were right. They're totally fucked up. You won't believe what he did last
yeah.
night. And I'm really sorry it happened in our room, but I was kind of fucked up. And make it a conspiracy between you two.
Yes.
Like,
include her.
Yeah, exactly. Because she wants that. She's been looking for these cracks in this relationship.
Because she feels far apart from
right.
him in comparison to
right.
Daphne and Cameron.
So I think that was Ethan's misplay.
Yeah.
And now things are weird between them. And Harper, I guess, is just trying to say, well, if you can have a crazy night out, I'm going to have a crazy day and
Harper
night.
Harper is yeah. on one. She yeah. looks amazing. She is drinking like a fish. When Harper turned in that way, I was 100% here for it.
Yeah.
It's like, don't get mad, get even in a way. But I think, not to sort of toot my own horn, but I think what I said last week or last time we had this pod, Harper being a bad Survivor player, is true, because she can't sit at the winery or at dinner for more than like 2 minutes without alluding to yeah. the fact that she knows the big secret, that she knows what happened.
Right.
And that sets Cameron off.
Mm-hmm.
Cameron now knows that she knows.
He knows that she knows. He kind of takes Ethan aside and is like, dude, what the hell? And he's like, it wasn't my fault. You left a condom wrapper in my hotel room, you idiot. Like, and Cameron kind of softens in that moment. He's not mad at Ethan anymore. He's like, okay, I screwed up, whatever. And then he has to scramble and be like, how do I deal with this?
That led me to believe the great listener theory, maybe to put more credence to the listener theory, that maybe Daphne and Cameron have been plotting this whole entire thing, because mm-hmm. that does seem like a pretty rookie mistake to leave a condom
that's
wrapper
true.
On the bed.
That's
true. I mean, on the couch.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, he was kind of wasted, but like,
true.
Yeah, I mean, this might all be part of a ruse. I think that later in the episode, Daphne kind of emerges steps into a more sinister light in some ways. Like, everyone is just being really weird at the winery, especially at dinner, and then at yeah. post-dinner when they're sort of outside in the
smoking
courtyard
cigarettes.
Smoking, and everyone is just, I mean, like, Cameron has already groped Harper under the table at yeah. dinner, and now she's staring at him, he's staring at her, and then there's Daphne, who's doing, like, just weird stuff and saying weird things.
I'm sure whatever happened wasn't a big deal. And if anything ever did happen, just do what you have to do to make yourself feel better about it. I have this trainer in the city, Lawrence. He's so handsome. He has blonde hair and these like big blue eyes. He's really funny, too. I spend more time with him than Cameron sometimes, because he's so busy at work. Such a cutie. Want to see a pic?
Yeah, I was legitimately confused and sort of scared. Not scared, but nervous about her conversation with Harper, where she talks about her trainer.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to lie, when she was handing over the phone, I was like, oh, it's going to be a dick pic or something,
sure.
or like he's
yeah.
shirtless or something.
Picture Jack.
Yes, a picture. Literally, it's Jack.
Yeah.
Like, literally, that just blew my mind. It's literally Jack. That would be crazy. But I expected something sort of, you know, like that, right?
Yeah.
And then what we see is a photo of her kids.
Uh-huh.
And at first I was confused. And then I noticed, oh, wait, the older one has blonde hair and really big blue eyes, just like she described the trainer as having.
Right, right.
So is she telling Harper that that kid is the trainer's kid and not Cameron's?
I mean, maybe. I mean, it might also just be kind of a sad moment of drunkenness of be like, oh, I meant to show you the fun thing, but here are the kids. Here's where my heart really is or something. I don't know.
Well, Megan Fahey is such a great actress that the way that she takes the phone and slams it down is like, oh, I was like, okay, that, there was something very purposeful and very sinister about what she just did.
Yeah.
And then she looks Harper dead in the eye and is like, do what you have to do to get through your marriage. I was like, okay, I do think now my prevailing theory is those kids, at least one of those kids ain't Cameron's.
I mean, she has alluded to already, like, I do my own things too, you know, and we don't know how serious that's been. I think it's also like, it's kind of fun to think about in the way that Cameron and Daphne do or don't at all relate to like Quentin, in that like Cameron is the one who says these people, like, they're house poor. You know, they have these mansions, but they don't have any money.
Yeah.
Is it possible Cameron and Daphne don't have any money?
Oh, I think it's very possible.
You know,
I think
this was their last bit of spending to get this money from Ethan. Yeah.
I really want to talk about Ethan and his mimetic desire. And Ethan reveals that Cameron would often sleep with the girls that he had crushes on in college. And that he still thinks about that, and that's still tough for him.
And there's a real darkness in his eyes when he says it. And it's the kind of thing where, like, I've certainly had moments when I've had something that I'm angry about bottled up, and then it finally kind of comes out, and you're almost vibrating with it. You're just like, and it's kind of scary.
It was scary. After that sort of monologue about mimetic desire and his vibrational seething of anger, I was like, oh, Ethan probably murdered somebody. Maybe it's Ethan. Not to jump to the end, but I was very much like, Ethan just shot way up on my list of potential suspects.
Right, because Cameron says, well, you didn't have more status than me or whatever. And he's like, not then.
Not then.
And like, there's that glint in his eyes again. And it's like, Ethan, I think, has sniffed out Cameron's desperation.
Yes.
And is like, loving it, you know, in a way. And like, now he's, at the very least, he doesn't share a lie with him. Like, Harper knows.
Yeah.
So Ethan is back on that side of things. And now then Cameron is the sort of, in this picture of things, like the weak figure in this person.
Yeah, but even so, I'm going to push slightly back on that, because even though that's true, Ethan was the loser at dinner. Ethan's sitting there, they're making fun of him. Harper's like, I had a threesome, not with Ethan, with Paolo and Oscar. And Ethan sort of looks kind of cucked, for lack of a better word.
Yeah.
And then right after the mimetic desire monologue, Cameron's touching his wife's leg under the table, sort of taking exactly what Ethan has.
He's doing it again.
He's doing it again.
Yeah.
So as though he's high status, he's also still the lowest status at the table.
Right. Well, it goes back to what Daphne said in at the lunch in Noto. These just sad, all men are just wandering alone. Mm-hmm. I think the big question I have that is certainly compounded and complicated by the scene in the courtyard after dinner is, what is Harper's feeling on this? I mean, clearly the breadcrumbs have been dropped for a Harper Cameron sort of thing from back to episode one, when he's naked in her hotel room, he swims, you know, he kind of surprises her in the
leg.
Water. Like, clearly there was something here. I guess the question is, does Harper want it?
And I think what's so brilliant about the show is, I think kind of yes, I think kind of no.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I don't think all is healed there and things are fracturing between Harper and Ethan and Cameron. I don't know if it's by design by Cameron, or if he just can't help himself. Now I'm like, oh my God, everyone's a con artist. It's Quentin, it's Jack, it's Cameron, it's Daphne. Wait, Cameron and Daphne might literally have money problems because Cameron hasn't paid Lucia yet.
Right.
Or they're...
He's paid her like a bit of it.
A bit of it, but he hasn't paid her all of it, and he keeps sort of deflecting. That is another... I think that, wow, that theory is getting more and more... true in my mind.
Yeah. I think after a slow burn, this episode is where, like, you're like, okay, now I can see people on the precipice of actual danger.
Yes. And now everyone is in it together. Every
sort
of separate group is sort of connected by one way or the other. And we see that in that wonderful hotel dinner scene where Lucia walks by, Cameron walks by Lucia and Albie at dinner, and then they go and sit down, and then Dominic's looking at Albie and Lucia, and it's all a huge fucking mess.
Yeah.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment. And when we return, a conversation with Adam DeMarco and theories about who's dead.
Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, with the help of Dan Adler and Olivia Nuzzi, we're going inside the media circus swirling around Donald Trump's criminal trial.
People want coverage of Donald Trump. There are sort of shades of 2015, 2016. I found it to be a total break from the reaction to a lot of Trump coverage in the last 2 years.
Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Well, we should go into Albie and Lucia and all of that. Big things this episode for... It's funny, the episode opens and closes with sex, right?
Yes. Two very different sex scenes for Albie and Lucia.
Albie is having fun with her, doesn't realize that she's a sex worker. And then there's this scene that is awkward and sad, but also kind of sweet the morning after, because I think they genuinely both had a good time.
I think that's true. And I think it's very much a two things can be true at once. Mm-hmm. Yes, Lucia is a sex worker, but yes, I think she actually had a good time with Albie and likes him. And I think we see that like of Albie, or that affection for Albie, grow over the course of the episode.
I think she's into him. I also think that it's possible that she has affection for him, but also has ulterior motives. I think there is that scene between her and Mia, where... right before Mia runs off and tries to be like, hey, can I sing again?
Yeah.
Where Lucia's like kind of, she's clearly thinking through something. And she says, I don't know, maybe we're not going to be punished.
Yeah.
And I think that's where she's like, I like him enough.
Mm-hmm.
I think I can get him to take me back to California.
Wow. I didn't even go all the way there.
I think she's like, this is my ticket.
This is my ticket.
This is a sweet guy. He's nice to me. Yeah, he's probably not for forever, but like, he's rich. He's young. He's handsome. Everything is lining up here. And maybe this is my way out of this life that I was really regretting just like the other day on the beach, you know?
Wow. I did not consider that. I think what complicates that is that she does know that that's Dominic's son, who she did have sex with, which now Albie and Dominic are Eskimo brothers. So we do have to, we must say that.
Yeah.
That is true. But I don't know how concerned. She didn't seem that concerned when Dominic confronted her about it at the pool.
I think that she is just like, do you want to tell your son you fucked me?
Yeah.
If you do, okay. No sweat off my back. But he doesn't want that information out there, which also made me worried.
Mm-hmm.
Mia's making moves in this episode in a way that, yet again, all these characters are moving towards risky things or already in risky things. And essentially, she's kind of blackmailing Valentina.
Oh, yeah.
In a way. Or trying to seduce her, or both, you know?
I mean, Mia's Anna Kendrick from the movie Camp moment, you know, the piano player's fucked. I'm ready. The show must go on.
Let me
play the piano.
If only she'd sung Ladies to Lunch.
If she had sung Ladies to Lunch, I would have absolutely screamed. But that's Amore. It was also great. But yeah, so she's found an opportunity, right? And she's like, I'm going to take it. And now she's feeling empowered by the sex work and senses pretty intuitively that Valentina is very lonely.
Yeah.
So lonely that she fires poor Rocco from the front desk.
Yeah, moves him down to the pool.
Moves him down to the pool just for talking with the object of her affection, Isabella. I think that could definitely end pretty poorly for Mia. I think she's going down a slippery slope.
Yeah, yeah. And like, you know, here the show might be kind of commenting on like, look at what, you know, people in the lower, in like the service class or whatever, like look at what they have to do to get ahead. They have to take a moonshot with some sweet, dopey, rich kid and like hope that gets you a plane ticket out of this place.
Yeah.
Do you have to kind of seduce and blackmail and all that stuff, you know, in the case of Mia? Like here are people scrambling to elevate their station, let's say. The sad irony being like, well, the people above them in the economic ladder are doing horrible things too.
I do want to know what you think about the conversation between Bert and Dominic at dinner.
I thought that was a really nice and thoughtful illustration of like, you can be in a tight-knit family and two different people within that family have wildly disparate perspectives on like what that family was.
Yeah.
You know? I really think that Bert is like, no, we loved each other. And I think he means that, you know, like, I think he thinks that, and whether or not that means he was totally oblivious to his wife's pain or if that means Dominic just saw it differently because he was younger and maybe didn't understand an arrangement they had or whatever it was, you know. I think they're both right and they're both wrong.
Yeah, it's a two things can be true at once scenario. And I do love that F. Murray Abraham, who, no criticism to The White Lotus, but I don't feel like we've gotten that much from him.
Yeah, someone had written in, I think it was Hannah in Italy, about weeks ago, about anticipating their trip to his hometown.
Yeah.
Or to his family's hometown. I'm wondering if maybe that's going to be a bigger Bert episode. I also think that we have to take note of him falling by the pool. And then he shows up in this episode and he's like, oh, I dropped the remote or something and I hit my head. And it's like, this guy is like not in great shape.
Yeah, he's falling a lot. And that second fall, I think, happened off camera. So maybe that's not what exactly happened. Like, we didn't see him hit his head.
Yeah, we don't know.
So that could be a whole other plot line or something nefarious there.
I don't think you bring F. Murray Abraham into the show to do what he's done
like
so far.
Fun one-liners and sort of like...
I mean, maybe that's the purpose he's going to serve. But like, I mean, I think that his character has been a little bit, I mean, really in the background. And so, I don't know, maybe he'll move toward the front.
Yeah, we'll have to wait and see.
So, Chris, you mentioned Alessio, which seems to be Lucia's pimp.
Yeah.
Where it kind of felt like in that street scene that maybe Albie was faced with a sort of like, what do I do here?
Yeah.
You know, a sort of small crisis of masculinity, a sort of force majeure moment.
Yeah.
You know?
Does Albie have to protect Lucia now? And does he, you know, try to, you know, does he murder somebody or try to fight this mysterious Alessio who we don't know if he exists yet? We just see her talk to some guy in the middle of the street.
Yeah.
That could be Alessio. That could not be Alessio.
Anybody.
I, up until this point, didn't think that Lucia had a pimp. I thought she was all sort of like sisters doing it or for themselves vibes.
Right.
So I'm still sort of skeptical about the Alessio of it all.
Yeah. I think, you know, and I think that what I like about sort of Albie's plot line is that what's happening isn't always clear. How people are feeling isn't always clear. I was curious about Albie. Mm-hmm. So I went to the source.
Ooh.
I talked to Adam DeMarco.
Oh, my goodness.
And, you know, he had some, I think he's very positive on who Albie is,
think
in a kind of sweet way. So why don't we listen to that interview now? Well, I'm so happy to be on the line now with Adam DeMarco, who plays Albie on The White Lotus. Hello, Adam.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
Good, thanks. So we're really excited to talk to you because my co-host Chris and I, like, we think that Albie is one of the most kind of almost hard to figure out characters. We can't tell, is he good? Is he a nice guy who's actually bad? So I'm curious just to start, like, what were your conversations like with Mike White in kind of building the character from the beginning?
Yeah, I think Mike and I were very cognizant of playing up Albie's sweet side and his sensitive side and his empathetic side. In terms of, like, being a nice guy, I don't know if there is such a thing in the world. I think everyone... you know, has everyone, people contain multitudes. Everyone has moments where they are, you know, the hero of their story and like the villain of their story. And I think, you know, reading online at what everyone's saying on Twitter and Reddit about Albie now is like so interesting. Because like you were saying, you and Chris can't figure him out. And I think the same could be said for like a lot of characters in the show, you know, which is just a testament to Mike's writing. Where it's like any one of these characters like could turn out to be, you know, the villain of the season or and it would be satisfying or not.
There's obviously what's on the page in terms of the character, but for you as an actor in your kind of process before filming and during filming, is it important that you have a deeper sense of where this character's coming from, sort of morally, ideologically?
Yeah, and then these were conversations I had not only with Mike, but with Haley Liu and Michael Imperioli and Murray, just trying to find out where he kind of sits in the greater scheme of the show. And then, you know, just trying to connect with those aspects of my personality and just finding, you know, those similarities and those ways into the character. And then a lot of it also was, I don't know if the word holistic is the right word, but just kind of, you know, trying not to overthink things and just kind of play as what you said, what was on the page, and just kind of let the writing kind of speak for itself.
I'm curious if, I mean, if you want to share, like, what do you think some similarities are between you and Albie?
Oh God. I don't know. I think we both live extremely in our heads at times and can overthink things to the point of debilitation at times. Albie has this obsession of not being like his father, but the more you obsess over something, the more likely you are to self-fulfill that prophecy or to like manifest that even in an unconscious way. So yeah, that was really interesting to see kind of how those scenes unfolded as we kept filming.
Yeah, Albie is certainly concerned with not repeating the sins of his father.
And the sins of his grandfather.
And I think in a more broad sense, like the sins of like
grandfather. Yeah, yeah, right.
The sins of masculinity, you know. And in so doing, he seems to sort of alienate Portia. They have like a friendly rapport, but like that spark that he felt for her is not really reciprocated because she's on her own sort of journey. How do you see like those interactions between Albie and Portia? Like, is anyone in the right, or are they both kind of confused in their own ways?
I think they're just two trains passing in opposite directions, and they had like this brief stop at the same station, but they can never really, you know, get on board with each other. They keep having these missed connections or this analogy just keeps getting better and better. It's the first time I've used it. Haley and I had this handshake in Sicily where we would go for a high five and then intentionally miss it every time. And sometimes I would forget that handshake and I would go to high five her and then she would miss. And I'd be like, oh, right. Or vice versa. And then looking back on it, that kind of is our whole character's dynamic. Like they never really hold hands or connect in that way.
And maybe, you know, in episode 5, it's something that Albie finds unexpectedly with Lucia, who he's not aware is a sex worker, and she kind of likes that about him. I mean, how do you read this kind of budding attraction between the two of them?
Yeah, I think what Albie finds in Lucia and what Portia finds in Jack, Leo Woodall's character, is that they both find that fire that was missing. I think what Albie likes about Lucia is that she brings him out of his head and into the moment and just kind of takes the lead on a lot of things. And then Portia's maybe expecting Albie to take the lead on things, even to the point where she's giving him like the note of being more aggressive. But then when he tries that, it's still not reciprocated. So it's just a lot of mixed signals and mixed messaging. And I think, you know, both of them just kind of find what they're looking for in these two new spicy Europeans.
Yeah. I mean, that sort of like aggression, or not aggression, but sort of assertion, you know, mm-hmm. take charge kind of thing. That is such a tricky thing, I think, for a lot of young straight men or any man really to navigate. Mm-hmm. Do you think that Albie's thinking on it is where it should be? Like, is he the right kind of enlightened about it, or is he being a little too? I mean, there are some scenes where it's like I've said to Chris on this podcast, like Albie's right, but he's kind of right in an annoying way. You know?
Yeah.
How do you view that?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of my female friends, you know, have told me, you know, the large percentage of the time when there is a vibe there, you know, don't ask, just like kiss the person, right? It's mm-hmm. so much hotter. But then there's always that, you know, 1 out of 10 times where it's, you know, you just have misread the signals or whatever. And I think Albie is, you know, would be mortified to not, to the point where he can't err on the side of caution or whatever that expression is. He prefers to err on the side of caution at all times, even when there is a glaringly obvious, you know, landing signal. Like,
yeah, I mean, I think that the way that Albie is trying to live more in the moment and Lucia sort of brings that out of him, is complicated by the fact that after this successful night together, this enjoyable night together, where both parties seem invested, not just in a transactional sense, Lucia says, okay, do you have the money? Like, do you think that makes Albie start to doubt his, that assertion and, you know, his kind of new groove? Or how do you think he processes the fact that, like, oh, Lucia was kind of entering into this as a business thing and I wasn't?
Yeah, I think he's definitely shocked and thrown off initially. He's a pretty innocent guy. I don't think he, you know, a lot of the other characters in the show, like Cameron and Ethan, were aware that there were these hookers in the hotel, even his dad and his grandfather, but he would, maybe didn't even know that that was a thing that happens. And then now that he's being confronted with it, he has to kind of face his own actions. And I mean, throughout the episode, I think you see him kind of come to terms with it in a modern way, where he checks in with Lucia, makes sure she's not part of like this, not being exploited by some guy. And he kind of makes it work for himself in a pretty modern, progressive way, where he sees it, you know, as long as it's her choice, then I guess what's the problem? Yeah.
We do have this looming figure in, I think Alessio was the name.
Alessio, yes.
Yeah, maybe Lucia's pimp or somebody like that. You know, obviously I don't want you to spoil anything that's coming, but like, are we right to kind of sense some mounting danger for in Albie's kind of portion of the story?
I mean, it certainly seems that way. You know, that their cute little ice cream date was ruined by Alessio. So yeah, it certainly seems like there's something coming for him.
I'm curious about Mike White as someone to work with and for. What kind of style does he have? Was he very conversational with you about like who this character was? Was he just letting you do your own thing and then kind of editing after a take, or how did that all work?
And he's a very observational guy. He doesn't really miss anything. You'll have a conversation with him and then weeks later he'll reference a micro expression or micro mannerism you had done and try to bring that into the scene. So yeah, he's a very observant guy and just wants to bring the truth of you into your character, which is a really vulnerable way of working, but ultimately very rewarding when you see the finished product. And I mean, I'm watching everyone else's scenes and I get glimpses into them. I'm like, oh, there's, you know, that's Haley. That's not Portia. That line was like Haley. And can sometimes he lets us improvise or ad lib as well. So that's pretty cool. And then also in terms of just direction, we just kind of played around with different, he'll let us do our own thing and then just kind of come in and massage and give himself options for editing, but it's very playful. Yeah, very collaborative.
And then you're also working with Michael Imperioli, F. Murray Abraham, these two, you know, kind of legendary actors. You know, Michael Imperioli on one of the greatest TV shows ever made, F. Murray Abraham, obviously Amadeus, a huge body of work.
Yeah, I think I've heard of them.
Yeah. What was your experience with them? I mean, were they imparting wisdom to you, or how did that work?
Yeah, the biggest wisdom I got from them is just to figure it out for myself, keep doing what I was doing, and that I, you know, deserve to be at that table with them, that literal and metaphorical table. They were very supportive. I loved rehearsing with them. We would organize our own rehearsals and just read all 7 episodes in a row, which I found super helpful. And it's not something that, you know, the younger generation of actors really do as much. A lot of it is kind of like, let's save it for the day and figuring it out on the moment, you know, figure it out during the moment of the take. But I've always loved rehearsing, and it was great working with, you know, Murray's classically trained, and then Michael's a big theater guy as well. So that was really cool. And, I was obviously really intimidated when I found out who was playing my fake family. I was like, I knew it would be insane, but you know, getting to meet them the second I met them, I just felt this instant kind of familial connection. And that never really, it just strengthened throughout filming. And, you know, during our rehearsals, we would also talk about our relationships with our fathers and our relationships with sex throughout our lives and what we thought of the Godfather. It was just really fun getting to know him on that level. And, you know, I still, we still text each other in our cute little group chat. And it's nice.
That's cool. Well, we're almost out of time, but and I'm going to, I guess, kind of end with maybe a difficult question. I hope it's not. But like, if you had to kind of, I don't know, say that the show, this season of The White Lotus has like a thesis to it. Like, what is it about? Do you have an idea of that? I mean, I know that's like, that can, it can be about so many things, but.
I'd say for me that, I don't know if it's a thesis, but just like one of the central messages is just how important communication is and just how important it is to have conversations and have tough conversations, especially with people you love. And that it's very rare. Things are very, very rarely black and white. It always meets somewhere in the middle. They should call the show The Gray Lotus. Sorry, I don't know.
Well, I think that that communication is so interesting because, especially for people of Albie and Portia's age and Lucia's age, maybe it's just because the demands of television, but like they're doing this communication in person, you know?
Yes.
So many young people are texting or whatever, DMing, you know? And I mean, do you think that like...
I just think there's nothing more important than open and honest communication and hearing and genuinely listening and hearing other people's points of view and perspective and leading with love, especially now, more than ever. I guess that would be my thesis.
Well, we certainly hope that love is what Albie has found with Lucia and she with
nice.
Him, but I don't know if that's really where Mike White stories tend to go. But we will eagerly, await the answer to those questions. In the meantime, Adam, really, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. And my tip for anyone listening who was a fan of the show is definitely to watch the finale live because, you know, things could get spoiled or tweeted about pretty quickly, you know?
Absolutely.
Definitely get caught up and try to watch it in real time if you can.
I think it's appointment viewing. All right, Adam, thanks again.
Thank you. Have a good one.
All right, Chris, it's time for the most important segment of this episode and every episode of Still Watching the White Lotus, Who's Dead? Just a kind of housekeeping note, we are recording this early because of the Thanksgiving holiday.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Happy Thanksgiving. or we hope you had a happy Thanksgiving.
yeah, I guess
so. We don't really have any new listener theories, so it's just going to be you and me. We don't have any cover.
Yeah, no, it's just us this week.
My new theory is that everyone's dead, except for Daphne.
I think that's probably the most compelling. After this episode, I'm sort of right there with you.
But if it's not everyone, who do you think it is?
Okay, who do I think is the most dead?
Yeah.
If I had to rank who's dead, who's most likely dead, after this episode, I'm going to have to put Tanya and Portia way up there because of what we saw from Dream Team Jack and Quentin. Clearly, they're up to something.
And there's lots of allusions to women falling from heights or betrayals and murders in
Sicily.
Madame
Butterfly, see Madame Butterfly. She doesn't make it out of that opera. Sorry,
right.
No spoilers, but you should know that.
Right.
So there are too many arrows and too many things pointing to the demise of Tanya and also Portia now. They're also away from the villa. I don't know.
Yeah.
I'm worried for them. But beyond that, my new wild card theory is that Ethan snaps on Cameron. That Ethan, things go, and that Daphne finds Cameron, her husband, face down in the sea.
Right.
Right?
Right.
Ethan has he has this bone to pick with Cameron. It's been years in the making. Cameron is probably going to fuck Harper. Let's say it. I'll say it.
Right.
I feel like that's where we're heading.
Yeah.
And if Ethan walks in on that, I absolutely think he could snap and kill Cameron. So that's my fun new theory for the week.
I think it could also be Ethan finds out about Cameron and Harper, if that's what happens with them. And I don't know how it comes about, but they somehow, both men, end up back on those goddamn jet skis, angry at each other, and this time one of them doesn't swerve.
Whoa.
And they both hit each other, and Daphne thinks they're off somewhere. She's having one last beach outing before they take the plane home.
Totally.
Maybe it's kind of an accidental thing where these two men, these two lonely wandering elephants,
yeah,
just crash into each other and kill each other.
They go head to head, and jet skis are so dangerous. My parents always told me that.
They're the ATVs of the sea.
Yeah. Really, truly. So that could be true. Yeah. I'm feeling now my dial, it's or the pendulum is swinging more to one of the foursome dying, more so mm-hmm. than an Albi, Mia, a Lucia. Yeah. It's
that foursome got so dark this episode. So
yes.
and full of tension that is new.
And vengeful.
Yeah, yeah, vengeful, exactly.
There's
That's
a lot
a
of
word.
Yeah. Vengeance.
Anger.
Mm.
Well, if you have a theory about who dies or really any other comment or question about The White Lotus Season 2, you can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Well, that does it for this week's episode. Again, you can email us at stillwatchingpod@gmail.com with theories or anything else, really. If you don't want to use email, there's always Twitter for now.
Yeah, we don't know how long that's going to last.
As of recording, there is still Twitter. I'm on there as Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me on Twitter or Instagram at Christress, C-H-R-I-S-T-R-E-S-S.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our editor and producer is Dave Gonzalez, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes and Katie Rich. We had technical assistance from Scott Lee. Steven Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next week for episode 6. Look forward to seeing you then.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
From PRX.